5 months of the biennium. And so they certainly are major cuts, that level of reduction in this short a period of time. And so would like to talk with you generally about kind of a general approach that we've taken to those reductions, and then turn it over to each of our assistant directors to discuss in a little more detail the approach that was taken for cuts, for instance, in child welfare and self-sufficiency programs in our health services area, including the health plan, and in our services to seniors and persons with disabilities. You should have two documents. One of them says Oregon Department of Human Services, January 2003, and I'd actually like to start with this one. I'll be jumping around a little bit, but I would like to use this as kind of the source document for talking about DHS and providing some information about how the budget works. If you turn to page 8 in here, it's an organization chart, and the reason I want to spend just a couple of moments and then come back to this is that we are in the midst of a reorganization at the Department of Human Services, but our budget is still built on the old budget categories. And so, actually, I don't know if you can see all the lines I was drawing yesterday, what's gone into what. If you look at the top part, you'll see kind of the new DHS, the current organization. And the areas that we'll be spending time with you talking about are seniors and people with disabilities, which is our programs, long-term care and other programs for services to seniors and persons with disabilities, including developmental disabilities. Children, adults, and families, which includes our self-sufficiency programs and child welfare programs. Health services, which includes public health, mental health, and addiction services, and the Oregon Health Plan. Community human services is actually the field structure for those services that are delivered by state staff. As we go through the budget, though, for this biennium, we still are using kind of the bottom charts. So you still will see adult and family services, health division, mental health, developmental disabilities, Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse, Office of Medical Assistance Program, services to children and families, and senior and disabled services division are the main categories. And then another category, which is department-wide support services, which encompasses the others. Our voc rehab services are actually within community human services. So I think we will need to go back to this as we further discuss the cuts that have been made or are being made. Pages 11 through 13 really explain kind of the major programs that we deliver in human services. And I'd just like to take a moment to briefly go through some of these. Children, adults, and families is the former adult and family services and services to children and families. It includes self-sufficiency programs around benefits for temporary assistance to needy families, formerly known as welfare or aid to families with dependent children, and training employment services and support services to help people, low-income persons who are on TANF move from welfare to work. We have prevention programs focused on teen pregnancy and other problems that are prevalent in children and families. And then a host of services that are around child welfare, child protective services, foster care, adoption assistance, really assistance with families to try to maintain children in a safe environment. If you turn to the next page, seniors and people with disabilities, this is really, in many cases, the long-term care part of the Medicaid program. And so although we have abuse prevention programs for elderly and persons with disabilities as well, most of what you'll see in the budget for this area is services to help people either stay in their own home or, if necessary, move into substitute care, whether it might be adult foster homes or other type of substitute care, and nursing facilities as well. We also have a large bulk of services to the developmentally disabled. As you may know, we've gone through the downsizing and eventual closure of Fairview Training Center, and so have a host of services in the field, most of which are contracted, but also some state-operated group homes to serve persons with disabilities, developmental disabilities. We have employment assistance programs to really help those who have disabilities become employed. And then lastly, a federal program, which is actually determination of eligibility for Social Security disability benefits, the developmental disability determination services. Within the category of services that are health services, this is the former, and it still is, Office of Medical Assistance Program, the services that were part of the health division or public health programs, mental health and addiction services as well. And so you have it within the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. This is really the kind of acute care, health care part of the Medicaid program. And you'll see we have Medicaid funding throughout our department. But this includes the Oregon Health Plan and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And between these two, we have over 400,000 people who receive benefits from hospital and physician care through dental and prescription drugs and mental health and addiction services, actually, as well. We have the medically needy program, which we will, I know you'll want to talk about some as we move into that arena, which is an optional program under federal guidelines, which is for people whose income is above that, which would normally make them eligible for Medicaid. We also help pay Medicare premiums for those who are low income. Within public health, on the next page, page 13, public health is really our population-based services, and the services there are delivered primarily through counties. So you have inspection of drinking water systems, regulation of ambulance services and hospitals, monitoring of lead and other toxic substances, work around communicable disease, chronic illness prevention, bioterrorism preparedness, large increases in this budget through federal funds within the last year, especially around bioterrorism. Maintenance of vital records. We have family health services, which include the WIC program, which provides nutrition assistance for low-income women and families, and our public health lab services. Lastly, within health services, we have the area of mental health and addiction services. These have been brought together. This is formerly part of the mental health part of the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division and the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. Mental illness and addiction often occur together, and so it does make sense to bring them together for purposes of better planning and integration. And so through here, you have outpatient and residential addiction and mental health services that are provided through counties and through local nonprofit providers. We also still have psychiatric hospitals that we operate in Salem, Portland, and Pendleton, and those are state-operated facilities, and prevention and treatment of problem gambling. That is really, those are our major service areas, and as we go through the budget, you'll be hearing more about these programs. I'd like to take a minute to talk to you about our service delivery system so you have a sense of who provides the services that are covered through the Department of Human Services. We do have some services that are state-operated and state-delivered. So those would be those, and as actually still in the current budget structure, it would include the field staff for the adult and family services and services to children and families would be included within those budget categories. Vocational rehabilitation services also, we have state employees delivering those services. There are some services, depending on the counties, for seniors and the former senior and disabled services division that are state employees who deliver them. Our psychiatric hospitals and some of our developmental disability group homes are all state employees, state-delivered services. Much of our service delivery system, though, is county-operated or county-delivered. So our mental health and addiction services programs through the county mental health programs, our public health through county public health programs, developmental disabilities are also by and large county delivered or county operated. And then in most cases, the services through seniors and the former senior and disabled services division are county operated. So we do have a large, maybe even a bulk of our services that are actually delivered through the county systems. Private nonprofits are used throughout our programs. We contract directly, or counties and may contract with private nonprofit providers to deliver an array of services, child welfare services, mental health services, services to persons with disabilities. We also have individual providers. Those may be foster parents, adult foster homes, client-employed providers, daycare providers. Again, we have a broad array of people in the community who are actually delivering these. And then we also have medical and long-term care providers. So your hospitals, physicians, dentists, pharmacists, durable medical equipment providers, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, providers who serve the general population and for whom Medicaid is one source of payment, in some cases may be a significant source of payment. The DHS budget on page 4, we just have, again, of this document, just a brief comment there, and then I actually want to turn to a pie chart after that. It's important to know that 80% of the money that comes through DHS actually goes out to the community. It's in payments out to counties, to providers, to individuals, grants, food stamps. I mean, it is money that goes out. 80% is actually goes out in terms of a payment from the department. About 16% of the department's budget is related to direct service by staff. So that includes our field systems where we have state employees, our psychiatric, state-operated psychiatric hospitals and group homes. 4% then is actually for central administration, the people who are over in the Human Services building, a couple of other buildings around Salem. If you turn to page 22, and this is actually for a chart that's from the 03-05 budget, but it's probably fairly similar to what we're seeing now, which is our major revenue sources. For the governor's balanced budget in 03-05, our total fund budget is about $8.6 billion. But of that, the general funds are only about 25-26% of the funds that are spent by the department. And of that general funds, almost 70% is for federal match or federal maintenance of effort requirements. Many of our programs require that for every dollar that's spent, the state puts up X amount. For instance, in Medicaid, it's about 40 cents state, and then the federal government matches it with 60 cents. But we also have maintenance of effort requirements where we have had block grant programs. So of that 25% general funds in our budget, about 70% of it is very much controlled by the federal government because it is match or it relates to our maintenance of effort requirements. The federal requirements, kind of the major areas where we have federal fundings, Medicaid, as I mentioned, is throughout the department. It's not only the Oregon Health Plan, but it's our long-term care services for seniors and persons with disabilities. It includes funding federal match for mental health and addiction services, child welfare, temporary assistance to needy families, vocational rehabilitation, again, throughout the department. And in our public health arena, we have much of what we have now is really federal grant funded, especially as we move beyond September 11th. Of the programs that require federal fund match, most of them are entitlement programs. And that means if a person meets the eligibility standards, we must serve them. We can't simply say we're closing the door because we are out of money. We actually have to change eligibility standards. And so one of the challenges we always have within the Department of Human Services is trying to project caseload when caseloads, many cases, are beyond our control and may be a symptom of what's going on with the economy or of the aging population. So again, in many many of the areas, for us to actually control who comes in the door, we actually would have to change eligibility standards. So it's important to keep that in the back of your mind as well. Now, with that as a context, we've been, as other state agencies, have been through a number of changes or reductions even before we got to the fifth special session. And so we kind of, wherever we could find other types of funds to fund something, federal funds or other funds, we went through fund shifts and backed out general fund. We held vacancies and abolished positions. We took service and supply reductions throughout the department. Actually, interesting, I was looking at some information this week, and one of the areas was in reducing the amount for attorney general fees, and I can tell you just based on the last couple of weeks with the various lawsuits, I think it's a full employment program for the Department of Justice. So we do have a number of areas that we may be difficult to achieve those savings. We've had savings from reorganization in the department where we have actually eliminated staff. Originally, we had hoped to use most of those savings to reinvest to support some of the facilities or training or system supports to help on the reorganization. We've been able to do some of that, but in most cases, we have just taken those savings as part of meeting reduction targets. There were a number of special emergency board reservations for caseload growth, for instance, and for, as I, for those of you who may not know, I came back into first the interim director of OMAP in October, and there were, in the 2001 session, there were a number of new actions to save money, but there had been a reservation because of concerns about whether or not those actions really would save money. They did to some degree, but that reservation was gone, because and the actions did not save the amount that we had hoped. There's been delays in expansions, whether it was the Oregon Children's Plan, a county quality assurance staff for developmentally disabled, mental health services, safety net clinics. So where the legislature had appropriated funds for expansion of programs, we had delays or reductions in those expansions. We also, prior to the fifth special session, took a number of program reductions then. For instance, reductions in our emergency assistance program and student daycare and child welfare services and state-operated group homes and sheltered services and then substance abuse services. And then lastly, provider rate reductions. Basically, second-year cost of living increases for most providers were gone. We also reduced what is paid to pharmacies for the ingredient cost of the drugs that are provided through the Oregon Health Plan. So now we come to our latest round of reductions. And as I noted, we have about $140 million of general fund reductions that we are taking in the last 5 months of the biennium. The November rebalance, we had over $23 million of program reductions that were necessary in order to meet our rebalance target. The December revenue forecast, as you know, the governor, to deal with that shortfall in revenue, has done issued an executive order for an across-the-board allotment reduction. The Department of Human Services share of that is about $28 million. And then lastly, House Bill 5100, or Measure 28, the amount that has been taken from the Department of Human Services budget for that is over $88 million. Now, on these last two, both the December revenue forecast and House Bill 5100, because those were across-the-board reductions and because they were across-the-board based on the budget structure that was in place before, the amount that's it really hasn't allowed us to look at priorities within the department, because as you know, when looking throughout state government's budgets, the dollars were taken, and depending on how much general fund was in there to start with, and so each of the areas, program areas, has a specific target that's already been established either through the allotment reduction or through the reductions that have already been taken out of our budget through House Bill 5100. And so in some cases that did not allow us perhaps as much flexibility as we might have liked, because depending on where something was, where the general fund is where the general fund goes away. The general approach we've tried to take, now, first of all, the November Emergency Board did establish specific reductions, but then the other two, the December Revenue Forecast and House Bill 5100, since the legislature, the governor in the one case and the legislature in the other, took those dollars away, then it's been up to us to determine how we would meet those goals, those targets. It has not been an easy process and continues to not be an easy process. I'm sure people will always argue that there's still some more fat someplace in the Department of Human Services budget and budgets throughout state government. The fact of the matter is statewide $600 million was already taken, and so before we ever got to these latest reductions. And so we are focused in most cases on services. Again, 80% goes out in payments. 16% is for direct support. And so you will see that reductions, we have really no way to avoid that when you have $140 million of reductions. We tried to look at those programs where it is only general fund that supports them. Because one of the concerns is that when we make reductions in a program that includes federal funds, not only are we losing the general funds, but we're losing the federal funds that would come into the state. And so we did focus on where we have programs that, not exclusively, but we did look at where there are programs that are only supported by general funds. We looked at how can we do this without endangering mandates that have either been that are either federal mandates or court order mandates. And we have been in the past in the midst of lawsuits. We are now again in the midst of lawsuits. There are certain settlement agreements we've made in the past that we need to try to live up to. We may not be able to do that with these latest rounds of reductions. We received significant flexibility from the federal government in October with waivers called the Oregon OHP2, Oregon Health Plan 2 waivers. By the time we are done with this, we will have used every last bit of flexibility the federal government provided us. So we're ready to move on to either OHP3 or OHP.75. But we will have used the flexibility we had. I don't think anyone thought we would have used it a month into the program, but we will have. Overall, we have tried to protect the most vulnerable. And I think that as you look at these reductions are very difficult on everyone. As I've talked with staff, people come to work for human services because they care about vulnerable individuals. And that's who we serve. And we are not saying certain people aren't vulnerable. We are saying some are more vulnerable than others, and we have to look at those who and protect those who are the most vulnerable. And there are many stories that you're already hearing, and we are hearing of people who have very real needs, who will no longer be receiving services or will receive less services. And even within those services, we tried to then see, could we reduce services rather than completely eliminating them? It's possible in some cases and not possible in others. Overall, we need to see what could be done quickly enough that we could capture this amount of savings in such a short period of time. I know I've been in a number of discussions, Representative Cruz has been in at least one meeting with me, where people have ideas on the Oregon Health Plan, if we did this or did this. And many of those ideas would take months of either negotiation with the federal government or development of requests for proposals and sending out and getting contracts in. Well, by the time we get those things into place, we're probably at the end of the biennium, and our ability to capture the savings is gone. So we needed to be able to see what could we do within the amount of time, and sometimes that means taking a rather blunt instrument to our programs. And it's something that, given the short amount of time we have to capture these savings, that is what we've had to do in many cases. What you'll see, and that the assistant directors will be using it as a guide, is this matrix here, January 2003 DHS budget reduction actions. I think you probably have one that was revised January 18th. We had a couple of revisions over the weekend. More to come, I'm sure. One of the things I found as I came into this position 2.5 weeks ago is that we have a number of different lists. We had things happening in November or as a result of the November rebounds. We have things happening right now that are actually the result of the 2001 legislature. We had a list of cuts for Hospital 5100, and then when we had to come up with another $28 million because of the December revenue forecast, a number of the reductions on the 5100 list moved to that list, and we had to put new actions then on the Hospital 5100 list. And it's been very hard for us to even keep up with what's occurring when and what's and why. And so which of these reductions will occur, whether Measure 28 passes or not, and which ones are tied to Measure 28. So what we've attempted to do, and I just want to kind of introduce you to this, is that we've tried to, in chronological order, because that's the order in which we're hearing and are implementing, and that as we move through each of these, you'll begin to hear or we'll hear more people expressing concerns. What is occurring, for instance, in January in terms of reductions, and what is that tied to? There are a number of pages of February reductions that are, in most cases, some of them are actually tied to November rebounds, but are tied to the December revenue forecast or Measure 28, or as listed in here, Hospital 5100. And then more reduction or additional reductions in March, so most of them, and then a few that are still out there in April or so. But you will see that the bulk of the reductions that we are taking in order to meet those targets are in February, and then some also in March. As we move into the kind of the meat of some of these reductions, I've asked the various assistant directors to discuss with you in more detail specifically how they approached the reductions. I talked to you generally about the approach we've had in the department, but how they approached the reductions that were necessary in their specific areas. And then they can also talk with you about specific reductions and maybe highlight some of the major reductions that are occurring within their areas. Before I turn it over to them to talk with you in more detail, though, I guess I would stop and see if you have some general questions that you'd like me to address. We'll be here today. We thought we'd shoot to try to get through this today, but also understand we may not, and that you may want us back on Wednesday to have further discussions.
Yeah, Gina, I think it's a reasonable assumption we may not get through it all today. Just a couple process questions here. The 5100 cuts don't actually trigger until a certification of the election, which will probably not be by February 1st. So I guess the question is that the notices that were sent out said the cuts take place January 31st. Well, win or lose, I mean, I think it takes probably a neighborhood of 5 days to certify an election. So you've cut you're planning on cutting things before the trigger, or
Mr. Chair, the money is already out of our budgets. What the election would do is restore money. Now, the question is the legislature want to restore the money in the amounts to which they took out the money? But the money is gone. And so we are, in most cases, you have some that aren't occurring until March. And I've had legislators over the past months say, well, let's just wait. You'll see in most cases, these reductions are ones that require a good deal of preparation in providing the legal notices to clients, in renegotiating contracts or eliminating contracts and making systems changes and working with the federal government. Our problem is that in order to achieve the savings. We can't wait. And so the money we have had to move ahead, the money is out of our budgets. We have had to move ahead assuming that the money is gone, because it is gone from our perspective. And Measure 28 would restore funding.
Okay, but you've also got the same date for the December revenue mm-hmm. forecast, and there's nothing statutorily that compels you to make those adjustments at a date certain, sir.
Mr. Chair, because those have been done through executive order, our problem again is that we have to achieve just on that one $28 million of program reductions, and if we wait. That's one less month, which means we have to cut deeper in order to achieve the $28 million in that period of time. So those aren't subject to the Measure 28 reductions, but are, in fact, reductions that the sooner we can make them, the less deep we need to go.
Okay. I guess my main concern is the whole cut package and looking for alternatives, and I'm just trying to kind of lay the groundwork for how we get from here to there. And I guess if I was king, I would delay implementation of 5100. But you guys haven't elected me king, have you? So that's part of our reason for being here is to explore from a legislative perspective any options to what's on the table that we can come up with, and that's trying to get a sense of. And now, would I be correct in assuming, because clearly, the former executive said to do this, and I'm assuming the new executive is still in line mm-hmm. with that policy. Mm-hmm. Any other questions of Jane at this time?
Yes.
Yeah. Representative Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to put a face to this, and probably you've already heard about Hoodview mm-hmm. and the suit that's going to be. Hoodview is six blocks from my home, and it houses 56 chronically mentally disabled people. The reason is strictly general fund, because it houses 56. Mm-hmm. If it only housed 16 units, it would be eligible. I mean, 16 people, it would be eligible for the federal funding match. All of these people have been given notices. How do you feel they will be absorbed into the system? If truly they are not going to be, if truly that facility is going to be non-existent?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, I'm going to give you a very brief answer, but I think when Barry Cast comes up here to do the presentation on health services, he certainly can tell you in more detail and will correct anything I say that's incorrect. I think that, first of all, we have tried to buy some time until April 15th to try to do some transition planning with the people who are there. There have also been discussions occurring with those facilities on whether they could be downsized into smaller units that are 16 and under to allow us to claim federal match. But I think when Barry does his presentation, if you don't mind waiting until then, he could discuss that specifically. I've said to various people that, and advocates and staff within the department, I think if we would have known, and I'm speaking big picture, not just DHS, since I feel like I've been dealing with the big picture the last few years. If we would have known at the beginning of the biennium we were going to be 1.8 or whatever billion it is in the end short of for the biennium, we probably would have at the beginning really looked at how do we do things very differently, how do we structure things differently. But what's happened, it's been every three months, okay, here's another couple hundred million to cut. And so we've had incremental reductions. We've tried to look at where can we cut out the, vacancies, positions, services and supplies, find the funds. How do we make some of these reductions? Each month, it's in, especially the last few months, it seemed, now we've got another set and another set. Certainly, if Measure 28 passes, that provides some relief for a few months. But you'll see there are still a number of reductions that are occurring, whether Measure 28 passes or not. The governor's balanced budget assumes that the cuts from House Bill 5100 would be in place beginning in July, though. We are talking within the department, and I know certainly on the health plan have begun having discussions with Representative Westland and others, and some of the stakeholders have saying we need to step back and completely relook at, because by the time we are done with these reductions, the program we may have, and I'm speaking specifically from the health plan since that's where I'm most knowledgeable at this point, is not really a sustainable program and a program that will do the most good. We really need to step back and say, are there ways to if we were starting from scratch? I've asked Cabinet to start thinking about that, start engaging in those discussions for other parts of the of our programs as well. But even there, to think that in 3 or 4 months we can completely rethink, figure out the ramifications, and involve everyone, including all of you, in those discussions and decisions, is terribly optimistic. These are usually, you know, two-year cycles of really relooking at systems. So I think I can say to you, coming in new, that we recognize we need to relook with our partners, with stakeholders, with you, at many of these areas, because what we may have in the end, as I said, we've ended up having to use some pretty blunt instruments in making reductions. But we're committed to relooking and to seeing how can we, there may not be too much we can do in terms of alternatives over the next few months, but are there things we could do differently as we move into 3L5?
Senator Westland.
Gene, just so my Monday morning mind is assimilated the information correctly, $140 million worth of cuts in the last 5 months, comprised of three components: e-board action, December forecast, and 5100.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Would it be reasonable to assume that you said you were acting director, you will at least be acting through the end of the legislative session? Are you...
Mr. Chair, I hope it's not that long. Let me clarify that. I didn't quite mean that. Governor Kulongoski has nominated me to be, but since it takes Senate confirmation, Governor Kitzhaber and now Governor Kulongoski have named me acting director so I can begin working on this within the department.
That was the answer I wanted. Yeah. I wanted to make sure that we weren't going to have somebody brand new
I have. Assuming I make it through Senate confirmation, the plan is for me to stick with this. So
Lisa's job's been made tough enough. We don't want to give her a new chief halfway through this.
Okay. From here, I think the order in which we had hoped to have, again, the assistant directors will provide you some information about what guided decisions around reductions in their areas. We are going to begin. We'll have Children, Adults, and Families, and Ramona Foley, who is the assistant director from there, along with Jim Neely, who is now the deputy director for DHS, but was Ramona's deputy, will do that presentation. After that, we'll move to Seniors and People with Disabilities, and James Taves, who's the acting assistant director there, will explain for that. And Health Services, which includes the Oregon Health Plan, Barry Cast, who's the assistant director for Health Services, and Lynn Reed, who's the acting administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, will cover that. So from here, I think I'll let Ramona and Jim come up. And
Senator Dalto has a question before you get away.
Mr. Chair, thanks. Director, just have a quick question. You started to describe some savings or efficiencies the department was able to find in the reorganization process. Has the department been able to put a number on that or give us kind of an idea of the scope?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, that's something we're working on. Originally, our target had been $10 million in savings, $4 million of which was given up originally, and $6 million was to be reinvested. I think in the end, there's about $2.5 million to $3 million is actually being, either has been or will be reinvested. Most of it has been spent. And so we have, we're trying to get, make sure our numbers are consistent in terms of the positions that have either been eliminated or held vacant. For instance, right now we have about 700 positions that are being held vacant either to achieve savings or that will be abolished. And so we'll be trying to provide some data that is consistent, because we've been through various special sessions and various e-boards and various allotment reductions over this last year. But it has been significant. So.
Well, it wasn't it $20 million in savings with $10 million reinvested?
I don't know. Is anyone shaking their head up and down?
No.
Okay.
That's what I remember, too.
Okay.
back during the last session when we were talking about reorg, that was the target. So...
all I know is those were the numbers when we came out of the session,
right,
the $10
million. Right. So I understand it's changed since then, but originally, going back to when we were in a simpler world, I think those were the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Phyllis is shaking her head, yes, so that's all we know.
Okay, so Phyllis is shaking her head.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Director Thorne, when you talk about reinvesting these savings, forgive me, do you mean reinvesting them in programs or...?
They had, Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, in reorganizing the department and restructuring the department to focus on service integration, the department had looked at, in order to, for instance, to better integrate services, one of the areas that we needed a lot of work on was staff training, management training around things like managing change, because there's huge, just when you look at those sets of charts, we've had huge changes and are in the midst of those as well. In terms of trying to have, we have a number of different computer systems, trying to have systems that can talk to each other or can be more consolidated so that workers can find out information about a particular client and the services that they're receiving from one source rather than having to go to various, or they may not have access to some of the computer systems. Moving, as we tried to move towards co-location of services so clients don't need to move to or to go to different offices, there are costs in terms of moving in facilities. Just as an aside, I guess I'd like to actually, while I'm here, take a moment to say to this committee, this reorganization has moved very quickly. And I think I personally, as I came in October and began experiencing it, had concerns that maybe we had not put all of the structures in place to make sure that our new structure worked. That's decision-making, processes, communication, functions. Concerns about linkages between the policy offices and the field offices. And so I have asked, I'm starting with our cabinet and then others, of saying we need to really stop and see where is this moving well, and we need to consolidate our gains and move ahead. Where do we need to rethink some of what we're doing? And certainly given what we have going before us over the next few months with the reductions that are occurring and potentially further reductions in 0305, we need to focus on the businesses at hand and not be... not let reorganization get in our way. And so we're not putting it on hold, because those things that make sense and we need to move forward on, if we can provide more effective or more efficient services, we need to do that. But we are slowing down and assessing where we are on reorganization. And the other thing is, by the time we come out of this session, the programs that we may have by themselves may dictate what our organization needs to look like.
May I, Mr. Chair, follow up with one last question? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Director Thorne. Would you say then that the goal of the reorganization as conducted this go-around would be to improve service delivery, or would you say that it was designed to reduce costs? Would you say that it was a combination of both of those things and more?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dalto, I would say that the focus has been on how can we better integrate services to clients and to, at the same time, do it in a more efficient way and allow us to reduce costs. There are a number of things that are more the functions of the department, where we've consolidated our contracting, where we've consolidated information technology, where we've consolidated some of those where you had separate functions in each of the divisions, whereby consolidating, not only do you bring some more consistency, but we can have some cost savings as well. The focus really has, as my understanding, having been out, I was off doing education for the last 5 years, but is that the goal always has been on how do we better serve clients in a more integrated way, and by doing that, can we also save money? And so it is some combination, although the focus really has been on how to better serve clients. Okay, and I'll turn it over to Ramona and Jim.
Okay. Committee, before Ramona and Jim start, Sandy's got a copy of the House Bill 5100 narrative, just apart relative to human services, so it'll give you something to follow along. Good morning.
Good morning.
One question before we get started. Are those chairs more comfortable than the old ones?
Absolutely.
I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get used to a color-coordinated room, but I'll give it a try.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families. And as Director Thorne indicated, I'm also serving as Interim Assistant Director for Community Human Services as of last Thursday. Jim, do you want to do your introduction?
I'm Jim Neely, currently the Deputy Director for Human Services and formerly the Deputy Assistant Director for Children, Adults, and Families.
And we thought we might approach this by talking a little bit about when welfare and child welfare came together to form Children, Adults, and Families. One of the commitments that we've tried to hold to is that we try to preserve families at the front end of the system, and many families on public assistance. The services they receive as public assistance recipients, whether it's TANF or whether it's food stamps, are the very services that may, in fact, enable the family to stay together. And so as we talk about the broad cuts that have been made in our programs, kind of keep in mind, if you would, that we are trying to say that families are very important at the front door, and we want to preserve as many of those families without children having to come into state custody unless that's necessary for their safety.
Okay, starting with this matrix document, let me just talk a little about the cuts that have affected what was the Adult and Family Services Division budget, and actually the first one on the chart. I say that having a slightly older version of the chart. I believe it's the first one. Eliminating the regular emergency assistance program. This cut, which is related to the November rebalance issue, is something that will eliminate the emergency assistance program for the balance of this biennium. We received a reduction in our requested budget during the 0103 session, and then I believe during the second session an additional reduction to that. Basically, the program ran out of money at the end of this year, and November eBoard was unable to restore funding. So essentially intake for the regular emergency assistance program has been shut off, although it could start up again at the next biennium.
Do you have and we should probably should ask this ahead of time, but do you have any dollar figures for, in this case, how much money would have taken to continue the services to the rest of the biennium, or in other things, how much the actual reduction is?
Mr. Chair, I believe in this, for the regular emergency assistance program, it was in the range of $300,000 to continue, and that frankly was a substantially reduced program. Beginning the biennium, it was a $350 maximum payment to families, and that was down to a $100 maximum payment.
Thank you. You and everybody else out there, if you can kind of put a number face on some of these things, it'd be very helpful.
Okay. Going to page 2, reduced jobs program spending from the December revenue forecast, about $234,000, and that was actually a balancer, if you will, because there were some things on our 5100 list that were actually used in November rebalance. And so between that and the December revenue forecast, the jobs program was reduced slightly again. This from a House Bill 5100 reduction, the next line down, about $2.1 million. Following that, actually three cuts to the employment-related daycare program. The first one increasing co-pays for families. The current minimum co-pay is $25 per month. This would increase that minimum and average across the board by $18 per month. That's about $1.4 million for the balance of this biennium. The next line, reducing eligibility for employment-related daycare by reducing the overall eligibility ceiling in terms of allowable income. That's about $274,000. And we'll just temporarily skip over the next line to the last employment-related daycare reduction, increasing co-pays by $19 per month on average, but holding the new minimum where it is at, I think, $43, and eliminating the two-month transition low co-pays into the system as people move from welfare to work. And that's about $1.2 million this biennium. And then finally, the cut right above that one, reducing the grant for temporary assistance to needy families by an average of $5 per month. And while that doesn't necessarily sound like a substantial reduction, it's a grant that hasn't changed since 1991 and, in fact, has been eroded by inflation since 1973. So the purchasing power of what was aid to dependent children and now temporary assistance to needy families is substantially less than it was in the 70s, and this is one more cut to that grant level. And that's about $500,000 this biennium.
That's $500,000 general fund, and how much federal fund?
Mr. Chair, that's a $500,000 general fund, and it is all general fund because with the TANF program, we're able to move between, because it's a block grant, move between general and federal because we have a maintenance of effort issue.
So that doesn't cost us any federal dollars by doing that.
Mr. Chair, not in that cut.
And if we look generally at the cuts that we're making in what used to be services to children and families, one of the things I would point out that the cuts that Jim has referred to mean that a TANF family of three will go from having a $503 a month TANF benefit to about $498. Keep in mind though that family of three, if the two children have to come into foster care, the foster care rate automatically will be about $400 per child. So we need to continue to make a strong investment on families and keeping families intact when at all possible. Because for one thing, it's good practice in terms of if children can remain safely at home. And secondly, it's also cost beneficial for us to be able to provide services to families so that all children don't have to come into state custody simply because there's a referral at some point.
What's the income eligibility level for TANF of a family of three?
It's approximately $619.
Our largest cut, you will see on page 8 of your document, the largest cut is the item called Eliminating the System of Care. And the System of Care, many of you know, was an agreement reached with the Juvenile Rights Project around 1995 to look at the quality of what happens in our foster care and adoption system. And we agreed to certain kinds of standards that we would adhere to. And with the loss of this money, this is about $4.7 million general fund. That includes about 30 staff positions, both in central office, there are a couple there, and then some in the field. But we are not abandoning the concept of the system of care. The system of care is a philosophy of a strengths-based approach to working with families, and we are intent on continuing that philosophy. That kind of undergirds our policies. It undergirds our training of our workers and our practice model. We're working with Angela Sherbo and the Juvenile Rights Project to try to hold clearly that we want to continue to try to meet the terms of the agreement, even though this $4.7 million general fund. And, again, that's on page 8 of your document, the second item on that page. We're also reducing special rates in foster care by about 10%, or $473,000 general fund. This we chose as a target. It's targeted because there's heavy general fund in it, just as there is heavy general fund with system of care. System of care is almost entirely general fund dollars. The special rates, we're taking the 10% reduction, and we chose to do that rather than having to impact the basic foster care rate. Ultimately, we also had to impact the basic foster care rate. So you will also see that we are going to be taking a 7.5% in adoption. That's in that same list, along with a 7.5% for foster care. And again, this was a difficult decision, but as I've talked with foster parents and some of the adoptive parents, primarily foster parents, they also understood that when we are talking about having to reduce a TANF payment to a mom and her children, that there's almost nowhere to hold parts of the system sacred in terms of looking across the board. I would say that the good news is Oregon has had a very good array of services and adoption assistance. We are ranked among some of the top in the nation in terms of what we're able to do with adoption assistance. And our foster care board payments, a real credit to the legislature here in Oregon, our foster care board payments have been quite competitive with other states. So while we are we don't like having to take the 7.5% cut, at the same time, we still are not going to be the lowest in the nation in terms of the kinds of assistance we're able to provide for foster and adoptive families.
Ramona, what does that total, the 7.5% reduction, what's that dollar figure reduction?
You have this in there.
You probably said it.
On the next page.
The next page. I'm sorry.
This is an incredibly helpful document. I really like this format. I just wish we would have had dollars.
Chair Cruz and Representative Westland, I too wish we had put those dollars on there in retrospect. And maybe we can do a new document and give you those dollars on the same document.
I mean, we're all up here trying to pencil in these things in the lines.
Sure. The adoption assistance, the 7.5% reduction, is a $1.245 million. In general fund. And the foster care, the 7.5% for foster care is a general fund saving of $478,000.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Ramona, I know you said the special rates to foster families for special needs kids, you said reducing them by 10%, but I didn't get the figure. What was that?
Okay, the special rates by 10%, Chairman Cruz and Representative Tomei, it yields a general fund savings of $473,533.
Thank you.
What federal funding stream is that tied into?
This would be tied into federal 4E dollars as well as some 4B dollars. And we also, in the revised chart, the new and improved revised chart, can show you the amount of the federal dollar savings as well as the state savings.
Thank you.
Other reductions are, they're smaller projects to some extent, but we're reducing the supportive remedial daycare by the elimination of a pilot project we had in three counties. Those counties were Marion, Lane, and Klamath. And we're also reducing our contracted family treatment and support by $167,000 in general fund. The supportive remedial daycare is a reduction of about $543,000 in general fund. Okay. On page 7, you will also see some reductions. These reductions, the one I just spoke about, the employment-related daycare, but also we are looking at some reduction in residential treatment, some reduction for children who need short-term placements, and some reduction in our Portland State University. And we have targeted those amounts. And what we're actually doing is we're not going to be closing a facility, to my knowledge, with these reductions, but we will be extremely diligent as staff make these referrals to facilities, and there could be some slowdown in the accessing of residential treatment for children in the long run. So these are pretty much the cuts that we have taken in children, adults, and families. And Chairman Cruz, if there are any other questions?
The residential treatment, is that mostly DARTS-type programs, or is that a separate category?
These would be 24-hour residential programs, not day treatment. These are okay. Residential treatment programs.
Where would I find the DARTS cuts?
I believe Barry Cast will talk about DARTS cuts.
Okay. I haven't got used to the new organization yet, so you have to bear with me as I can't figure out what's in what box. So... any other questions for Ramona at this point? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next is James.
Mr. Chairman, James Taves with Seniors and People with Disabilities from the Department of Human Services. Let me talk briefly about some of the decision-making around the reductions and some of our lengthy discussions we've had with the federal government as well. Seniors and People with Disabilities serves over 30,000 individuals, both elderly and people with physical disabilities and developmental disabilities as well. The vast majority of services that we provide is through local partners, so through local area agencies on aging, county mental health and developmental disability programs, who in turn subcontract with many community nonprofit agencies. So again, the vast majority of what we do is through local partners, and then a smaller percentage is through state employees in some of our field offices across the state. The reductions in the 5100 and in the allotment reductions, our programs are separated. Developmental disabilities comes out of the former mental health and developmental disability division, so the allotment in 5100 cuts in developmental disabilities came out of that old division structure budget, and then the seniors and physical disabilities came out of the old senior and disabled services division. So there's two different reduction targets in two different divisions that we've been working on. In developmental disabilities, the combination from the revenue shortfall in December and the House Bill 5100 cuts comes to about $16 million, which is, if you look at the general fund left in the budget from now till the end of the biennium, about a 25% reduction in the general fund as our target. On the senior side, it's the revenue shortfall from December was about $7 million, and the 5100 reduction is $22 million, coming to about a little over $29 million combined, which is close to about a 30% reduction in the general fund of what we have left for this biennium. Nearly everything we do is through the federal Medicaid program. We have large home and community-based waiver programs that serves all of our populations. As some of you know, Oregon was one of the first states that utilized waiver programs in the country, which allowed us to take dollars that historically had served people in institutions and be able to support them in community residential programs, in their own homes, with assisted care in their own homes, and in a variety kinds of ways that would allow people to stay independent and functioning as best they can in their own communities without institutional kinds of care. So all of those are based on federal Medicaid programs that we have to apply depending on the type of Medicaid waiver we have. Every 3 to 5 years, we have to reapply with the federal government and go through a series of lengthy negotiations to set those waiver amounts in the categories of services. So we've been very challenged in the last period of months in almost nonstop negotiations with the federal government on how to change those waivers to look at the kinds of reductions we're taking. And, of course, our assumptions kept changing, changing as the dollar amounts kept changing. We had to keep switching from different eligibility groups. So it's been a sort of a nonstop dialogue with the federal government and very confusing for our local partners and for our clients as well, as we've gone through these myriad discussions and alternatives that we had to explore, since at the end of the day, we have to get approval from the federal government on the reductions. What we tried to do in looking at all the reductions is preserve services for people with the most severe impairments, to serve the most vulnerable, as Jean said, to look at our Medicaid programs where we could preserve a federal match wherever possible, and lastly, to try to preserve some level of provider capacity so our whole service system didn't start to sort of disassemble as a chain reaction. But I think you'll see the size of many of the reductions begins to compromise those principles as we get to the reduction targets. Mr. Chairman, using the grid that you have, I'll just go very briefly through each of these. I think I know the dollar amounts for the most part and be able to tell you the numbers of people that are impacted. On the first page, the second item, and you'll see this in a couple other places, we have cut three crisis homes primarily for kids with developmental disabilities that were never opened. They were actually a holdover from the long-range plan to close Fairview. They were originally scheduled to open in the 99-01 biennium and were shifted into 01-03, but because of the succession of budget problems, we kept delaying and capturing the savings through various rebalances and the first several special sessions. But in the budget and for 03-05, all three of those crisis homes are now eliminated. The last item on page one, in the third special session, we capped the home and community-based waiver for the first time and have begun to set up a waiting list so people who still are eligible for institutional care who otherwise would be served in our home and community-based programs, we've capped that amount, and we will have to set up a set of criteria on who we allow community services in the order of the most vulnerable.
Jim, if you're aware of the savings, are you going to be giving us those figures as you go?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, I will. I don't have it for the items on the first page, and I apologize, but we can certainly get those for you. Page two, again, there's the second crisis home that's eliminated, and I don't have that dollar amount with you, but we can get that. Okay, for the Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, for the two different homes that were delayed, one was $245,000, the other $122,000, a little bit more than that for each. Then, Mr. Chairman, moving to page six is where the really big items begin. And let me talk a little bit about the rate reductions first. The rate reductions for all of our community programs, including nursing homes, assisted living facilities, foster care, residential care facilities, have actually been priced in probably six or seven different increments through all the different special sessions and the December revenue shortfall and the House Bill 5100 cuts. And I can kind of pull those apart, but they're all coming to a head now, and most of them go into effect on February 1st. And the cumulative effect is about a $10 million reduction in general fund across all of those different programs. And again, those are all matched with federal funds. To give you an example of that impact in different kinds of programs, for adult foster homes, for example, that represents about a 15% reduction. For residential care facilities, about a 15% reduction. For nursing facilities, to the basic rate, it's about a 16% reduction. And to assisted living facilities, and we had this debate during the last regular session, it's a significant reduction of about 30%. So we are rolling back rates in this proposal almost to 1999-01 levels. And again, those were priced in a lot of different increments, some from the special sessions and some as a result of 5100. But they all land on the February 1st date. The last item, Oregon Project Independence, this is actually misstated. The reduction to OPI, to Oregon Project Independence, so far through the different actions has been about $3 million. So the starting allocation at the beginning of the biennium was 13.7. The remaining allocation for the whole biennium is then $10 million, not the $3 million you see here. Moving to page 7.
Mr. Toth, before you move on to page 7, can you tell me how many times Oregon Project Independence funding has been cut in the past 2 years? I know that it was on again, off again, restored, cut. Do you have kind of a sense?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, the entire Oregon Project Independence program was slated for a complete reduction in the 2001 session in the governor's recommended budget. The legislature, by the end of the session, had completely restored that program. We've taken three separate reductions now through the special sessions, moving up to the February 1 date, the last amount that's scheduled for February 1, although it's actually taken off of the allotment reduction in December, is another $1.1 million. So that totals, in three different increments, $3 million off of the $13.7 million allocation for the total program.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
How many people are you looking at there that are going to fall out of that program? Some may be saved by their families, but the Project Independence.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, the total number of people that will be reduced is I can't give you the figure for this biennium. Typically, we serve close to about 3,000 people, 2,700 people a month in that program. Since we've made incremental reductions, I can't give you the figure right now because all of our local area agencies on aging started cutting back the program and either serving less people or tightening up the criteria for people to enter the program. I think the program is not in the recommended budget for next biennium, so it would be that full number of people that would not receive services in OPI. But since it's only been a percentage reduction this biennium, but I think we could probably get that data for you. Mr. Chairman, then moving to page 7, the first item, elimination of 95% of the general assistance program, which as you can see there serves 2,678 people. That's a $2.8 million reduction. And the reason it's a 95% reduction, this was another item that was taken off of the House Bill 5100 cuts, moved to the December allotment reduction, and under the governor's allotment reduction authority, he cannot eliminate entire programs, and that's why it's a 95% reduction. But then you see in the next item that the last 5% of the general assistance program goes away on February 1st with the House Bill 5100 cuts. And that's about 2,700 clients. For the most part, they are clients that are in the application pipeline to get Social Security Disability Income, or SSI, for whom we provide a small monthly stipend during that application process, and often they are eligible for some health care benefit during that time as well. Moving to the third item, and this is where the big level cuts begin to occur, and for some of you who are not familiar, in the senior and physical disability programs, we rank vulnerabilities by levels. 1 through 17, with 1 being the highest possible impairment and level 17 the lowest level of impairment. And the impairments are based on assessments which look at people's mobility needs, ambulation needs, assistance with eating needs, assistance with toileting. Virtually all of your activities of daily living are ranked in these priority scales on which the level of vulnerability of the person is ranked. And so as we went to the rate cuts and the elimination of general assistance and all of the general fund programs, that left us very little place to go except into the sort of the heart of the long-term care system. So here's where the level reductions began, and this is levels 15 through 17. And just to give you, it's a $5.3 million general fund reduction. The number of clients affected, it affects over 3,000 clients who get services in their own home. Again, attendant care or chore help or a variety of assistance in their own home. It affects over 700 people in substitute care who might be living in foster care and assisted living facilities. It affects a small number, 84 people, in nursing homes. And again, at these higher impairment levels, it's primarily people that need some level of assistance in ambulation, bathing, or dressing where this reduction takes place.
Ms. Staves, I had heard that the cut was going down to level 10. Where would I find that?
Mr. Chairman, we'll get to that in a couple of pages.
Okay.
It does go down to level 10, Mr. Chairman. But we've taken these cuts in two different increments because they're based on different time frames. And they're based on different time frames because we tried to allow longer amounts of time for people with more difficult impairments to allow for some form of transition planning, plus additional negotiations with the federal government to secure approval of the waivers.
Yeah, just a second, Sandy.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe when you arrived in the meeting today, there was a document on top of your supply that says survival levels. Those are the 1 through 17 that Mr. Taves is speaking to as a point of reference.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Then, Mr. Chairman, if you move to page 10, the first item is really the reduction on the developmental disabilities side. And what we did there is we attempted to preserve 24-hour care. Again, for people with developmental disabilities, for those of you who are not familiar, these are primarily people with mental retardation. The vast majority have mental retardation with IQ scores of 70 or below. Many have accompanying disabilities of cerebral palsy and other kinds of physical anomalies and medical problems. Includes kids and adults with autism and some other conditions as well. In this reduction, we attempted to preserve 24-hour care for people with this level of disability. We serve about 5,000 people statewide in 24-hour services, be it group homes or foster homes, and we tried to preserve that. So the reduction is taken almost entirely in the non-24-hour care side. So it affects most heavily families, where we give family support payments to families to help their sons or daughters stay in their own home. It eliminates vocational services for individuals who are not living in our 24-hour system and live at home with their families. It eliminates most of the all of the payments that otherwise would have gone to individuals and families under the Staley agreement, although the Staley issue is still pending. But for the House Bill 51 target, and this is a $12 million amount. The other $4 million in the allotment reductions came by forced savings in reducing crisis services across the state. But this $12 million amount is what you see right here.
Is this going to trigger more Staley suits? Say if Staley. My question is, does this go contrary to the agreements under Staley enough that we're going to see multiple lawsuits come out of this?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if more lawsuits, the Staley agreement itself was the settlement of a lawsuit,
right.
And if we end up breaching the agreement, which this would probably do, then we're back to the lawsuit, or we're back in court on the breach of the agreement, and we're still discussing and debating whether there's some way to salvage this agreement, and we haven't come to a decision yet, but we're very aware of that.
Okay, I guess if we are assuming this is a breach and it's going to trigger the lawsuit again, then this may end up costing us more than we're attempting to save. So,
Mr. Chairman, this is a difficult situation, and we're trying to weigh all those alternatives right now. And, Mr. Chairman, I should point out this reduction was originally scheduled for February 1st to get to the target. It's now moved to March 1st because of some additional time to discuss where we're going to go with the Staley agreement. And actually, by having it moved out to March, it makes the cut even deeper. We haven't priced what the deeper cut would be, but since we now have less time to make up the reduction, we'll have to look at that again. And then, Mr. Chairman, if you go to the last page, your previous question on the additional level cuts, this takes the survivability level cuts down to level 10 through 14, and again, it was priced in a different increment than the 15 through 17. The effective date is April 1st.
Okay.
We don't have that.
It's not on...
Page 12, you may
have
to...
We have the page 12.
We're missing in what you handed out. We're missing page 12.
How weird.
But,
I have page 12, but I don't have an April date on that.
Yeah, I have April 1st. If I may look at our earlier...
Oh, that has... Yeah, earlier one has page 12.
Yeah.
Okay.
Page
I guess one version had the 12 and...
I don't need it.
Mr. Chair, while we're
Dalto.
Dealing with technical difficulties, massive questions.
Yes,
I think, or make an observation to the agency, I think it'd be helpful, for at least for me, to have a total number of human beings that are being affected by 5,100 cuts. I mean, I sort of see piecemeal 5,000 here, 24 people here, blah, blah, blah. If we could have a total listing of souls affected by these cuts, I think that'd be helpful. Thank you.
We now have it.
Mr. Chairman, we apologize for that. The this is levels 10 through 14. It affects 4,813 individuals. The size of the general fund reduction is $4.9 million. That would take effect on April 1st. In these impairment levels, we particularly when you get to level 10, you're talking about individuals that have significant needs for assistance in mobility and ambulation, both in the home and out of the home, plus assistance in eating and toileting and dressing and bathing and things of that. But level 10 really starts triggering the major mobility issues in our impairment scales. And again, to give you the number of clients affected, it gives a total number there, but to break it down, it's over 3,000 of our clients that receive significant support in-home. It's about a little over 1,500 in substitute care, living outside of their own home, and about 190 individuals in nursing facilities out of levels 10 through 14. And again, that was delayed till April 1st to try to give additional time for our case managers and our field staff to try to provide support and assistance in any kind of transition.
I think a logistical question on this, because these are Medicaid programs. If you make the cut, the client who's losing services has the right to a hearing on that cut before the cut can be made. And I added the two boxes together and came up with 8,990 clients you're dealing with. And if all of them requested a hearing, and I think there's something like 18 hearings officers logistically, how long would it take you to do that?
Mr. Chairman, a couple of responses. Number one, in addition to losing long-term care, many of the individuals also lose eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan, and that gets very confusing depending on whether they get Medicare or they don't get Medicare. And but some of them will still be eligible for parts of the health plan, and some of them will not. And I forgot to mention that because that's an added or a cumulative effect on the loss of services. On the hearings issue, we have had many hours of discussions both with the federal government and with our own attorneys on this. And where we've landed for now is that if a program is being completely eliminated under federal Medicaid law, if a program is completely eliminated under state law and policy, and that's considered a mass change of eligibility for that entire program, the person does not have hearing rights. In the level cuts, and I think there's still disagreement about that, I'm just saying where this debate has gone. In the level cuts, what we have said at this point in time is the loss of services based on the level cuts, so 15 through 17 or 10 through 14, is not hearable. What is hearable is your assessment. So if you believe that you were not appropriately assessed and that, in fact, your level of need or impairment is higher, and for many individuals who haven't been assessed, we need to go back and reassess them anyway. For every client potentially losing services, we have to, again, look at their income. We need to look at their assessment before we can make sure they're not eligible for other parts of the system. And we expect many individuals will, in fact, say, my assessment is old or it's wrong. You haven't accounted for my additional needs in this particular area. And we'll have reassessments, and out of reassessments, we'll have hearing requests related to that. If we end up being challenged and if hearing rights go to everybody, where virtually all the programs go away, including general assistance and medically needy and others, you're absolutely right. We would have thousands and thousands of hearing requests. And if the ruling was that the technical term is aid paid pending, where we have to continue the benefits during the period of time that that the hearing goes on before it's resolved, then any dollar amounts or savings that we have here would begin to evaporate very, very quickly. We have met, Mr. Chairman, with the hearings panel. We're quite aware of the workload. We'll probably be looking at bringing some retirees and other people that have experience with hearings back or contracting for additional help. We expect a very significant workload. But in the meantime, we have done hours of training with our field staff and our case managers and our area agencies on aging, a whole series of netcasts in terms of how we're going to process individuals through the reassessment and income redetermination, and obviously that's a very enormous workload as well. So it is daunting, Mr. Chairman, and very, very disconcerting, very troubling for our clients, obviously, who are unsure of exactly what their rights or appeal rights will be.
Yeah, I've been hearing from your clients, and in fact, some of your caseworkers have said to call me, and I appreciate that. So you're based on your discussions with the feds that say total elimination, there's no right to hearing, that would allow you to tell the medically needy clients that there's no right to a hearing because that's a total elimination. Would that be correct? Even though it's, I guess I'm a little surprised that the federal government is willing to give you that sort of flexibility with federally funded programs, but having said that, but when we get into the assisted levels, that's really, you really don't know what the final outcome of that is because it's not elimination, it's just a reduction.
Mr. Chairman, again, the difference in federal law under the Medicaid program is between mandatory services and optional services, the home and community-based waiver is an option. It's not mandatory. Medically needy is an option. It's not mandatory. And so there's sort of differences in depending on whether it's mandatory or optional. And again, our understanding after many hours of discussions is when you're eliminating an entire program, there really is nothing to appeal back to because the entire program under state law or policy has been eliminated. The level cuts is a more interesting discussion because you still have a home and community-based waiver. You're still serving thousands of people in your array of services. You've just shrunk the number of people that are eligible for those services. And again, what we're saying is as an optional services under the waiver, the eligibility is shrunk down to level 10. And so that is a mass change for levels 10 through 17. And again, what's contestable is not the elimination of those levels, but your assessment which placed you in one of those impairment levels. That's the position that our attorneys and we have taken at this point.
Okay. What would, let's take the medically needy program, what would our elimination at this point in time of that program do to the status of the waiver under which we were able to do that? Does that go away and we have to start from square one if we want to go back there, or is it still in play?
Mr. Chairman, I have to defer on that one.
Mr. Chair, Gene Thor, medically needy is outside the Oregon Health Plan. It's
right.
An optional program outside there, so we have a relationship to.
Well, I mean, we've
or
got
ability to keep
okay.
Waivers.
I mean, we've got a zillion waivers,
mm-hmm.
So that there's no specific waiver that allows us to use Medicaid dollars in the medically needy program.
Mr. Chair, if medically needy is a Medicaid, state, federal Medicaid program, states can choose to cover the medically needy or not. We have chosen to cover at this point for the last few years just the elderly and disabled and just for prescription drugs and mental health treatment. Again, it's people who have incomes above the normal the normal Medicaid eligibility level. So we can eliminate the program. It's an optional program. It's not tied in any way to our waivers for the Oregon Health Plan.
No, I wouldn't assume. I mean, not all of our Medicaid waivers are OHP, are they?
No, we have waivers in home and community-based services as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a matrix, Gene, of I know Medicaid is really hard to get your hands around, but it might be helpful for the committee if we had kind of a breakdown of the Medicaid programs that we have, mm-hmm. that we've gotten because of a specific mm-hmm. waiver or some, like, see, I was assuming the medically needy was a waiver program, and you're saying it's mm-hmm. a optional program,
yes.
that is there at the federal mm-hmm. level. It'd be kind of nice if we had kind of that breakdown mm-hmm. of those different.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't think we have one available, but we certainly can do that as kind of a Medicaid 101
okay.
for you as well.
That would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, unless there's any other questions.
Any other questions with this panel?
Thank you very
much.
Representative Dalto.
What am I supposed to tell my constituents are contacting me about the general assistance program being and losing that benefit? It's more of a rhetorical question, but I just would like to make the observation that I'm very concerned about a lot of these specific cuts that are affecting real people, my community, communities across the state, and it's very difficult for me as a new member to sit here and go through this list because I know there are a lot of people connected to these cuts. So just an observation.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, here.
Thank you. Barry.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. I'm Barry Cast, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services for Health Services, and I'm joined by Lynn Reed, our Acting Administrator for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. There has been a cascade of acting positions as a result of changes in the department. Lynn, however, has been really providing the technical direction for the Oregon Health Plan for a long, long time, and is here to answer those very specific questions, which I know will come up as a result of this presentation. This is a huge undertaking. The budget for health services for the department is over $4 billion. It's about 43% of the DHS budget. We have about 25% of the department's employees as well, but most of those people are employed at the Oregon State Hospital, Salem, and Portland campuses, or the Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center in Pendleton. And we have about another 100 employees at the Public Health Laboratory. So those are really sort of direct service workers. The balance of our employees, about 800, are in program support or administration, either in mental health and addictions, in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, or in our public health services, which are based at the Portland State Office Building. About 500 people work at the Portland State Office Building. We have about 120 programs there. It's kind of like a little university. There are dozens and dozens of grants from the Centers for Disease Control, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other parts of the federal government that look at things like lead toxicity, site contamination, drinking water, immunizations. It's a vast and complex undertaking, and it'd be difficult for me to describe it all for you here this morning. But what's probably the most important about that is that, in contrast to much of what the department does elsewhere, public health services are really population-based. That is, the clients that you see across a number of programs are really not there. It's the whole community which is the client. When you go into a restaurant, you want to know that the food that you're going to eat has been prepared under the proper regulations and will not make you sick. When you turn on the tap, you want your water to be clean. So we do a lot of that, and there's a lot of regulatory work that's done there. There are also client-based services in the in health services. For example, we serve about 150,000 people with mental illness or addictions or both during a biennium. OMAP has 440,000 people at any one time and probably serves closer to 550,000-600,000 a biennium through the Oregon Health Plan, which is kind of like a large insurance company. So you have a range and complexity of service delivery, which I think needs to be appreciated at the outset. A second thing that I think is really different about health services from the rest of the department is that, in contrast to delivering services through our own staff, with the exception of the state hospitals and the lab, everything we do is done through either partnerships with the counties or contracts with vendors, private, not-for-profit vendors. So, for example, we have community mental health agreements with every county in the state. We have contracts with child residential programs for psychiatric residential services, the day treatment programs that you referenced earlier, Mr. Chair. And because we work through the community, that means that most of the resources here are going out and serving people through other vehicles than through state employees. And our job is to efficiently and effectively regulate those and administer them. When you look at health services, general fund is concentrated really in two main areas. First, because of a long-standing tradition that state hospitals are the responsibility of the state and not the federal government, there is a tremendous amount of general fund based in our mental health programs. And secondly, the Oregon Health Plan requires over $700 million in general fund and lottery fund match to bring in those federal resources that in combination produce what is the Oregon Health Plan as well as other Medicaid-funded health services. Only a small fraction of what we do in health services is really in state administration. But that issue has come up, and I'm happy to discuss that if you'd like to do so. Most of these services are provided directly to communities or to clients through other entities at the local level. All of the cuts that we'll talk about this morning were made to achieve statutory allocations, either through the direction of the emergency board in November the 5100 targets or the targets that were mandated in the allotment system for the $28 million reductions. So let me walk through these. I want to talk about the principles and then the specific list. Public health, in spite of the importance and its breadth, only consumes 1% of the general fund budget of the department. Most of the money that we get is either fees or federal funds. Cuts there were made in areas where alternative services likely were available. So, for example, when you see a cut in school-based health care, most of the revenue for school-based health care comes from other sources, including reimbursements, both under the Oregon Health Plan and private insurance. Cuts were made in allocations to local health departments in recognition of the infusion of new federal money related to 9/11 and to the bioterrorism preparedness grants, which totaled $14.1 million during this biennium. But I want to make very clear that while these new funds do not really provide a comparable service, that is, we're out there with funds for counties to look into tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases. That's really not what the bioterrorism preparedness money is for. The federal government gave us those dollars with the concept of dual purpose, to support local health, public health infrastructure. So it made this reduction tolerable, not wise. More than 10% of public health general fund is allocated to our school-based health centers in 20 of 44 sites around the state. And while this support is extremely important, other ongoing sources of revenue are available to these programs. I want to tell you about a remarkable phone call I had from the chair of the school-based health network, who said, if you have to cut the general funds for the programs, do so, but keep the administrative staff at the state level because it helps us stay certified and able to collect these funds. We did not do that. The state staff associated with the program are also being reduced. In mental health and addictions, there are a couple of...
Stop
yes.
there for a minute. If it's important, the certification is important, and you still have a lot of administrative staff in the Department of Human Services, how time-consumptive is that, and could that be picked up somewhere else? So, I mean, you know, and I know Representative Mona Sanderson has a keen interest in these programs, as do I. So I'm just wondering if it's necessary to totally drop that ball just because of the change in administrative structure. Have you taken a look at how else you could still allow these facilities to remain certified?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I understand fully the question.
You referred to a phone call saying, I'll either
right.
keep the administration so that we can keep our certification. And I'm just wondering, it would seem to me that there should be some way, even with loss of some administration in the department, that certification could still be something that could be accomplished. And I'm wondering if you've looked at that.
Mr. Chair, we can look into reallocating time from other staff. The three staff who were funded in this specific program are part of the layoff list that is currently ongoing in the department. So the principle in those reductions was that we don't preserve state administration while we're cutting program at the local level, that those two go hand in hand. Having said that, the kind of technical assistance those staff provide, we may be able to find an alternative to that. But that was a highly specific program and located in our child and adolescent health office in Portland, and I don't know what the remedy would be. I'll have to go back and look.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the existing school-based health center still be sending all of their data to the Department of Human Services like they do now? I mean, is there going to be a tracking? Will we be getting data from these, or with the elimination of those positions, will all the data then just go into a black hole if they're sending it?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry that I have to say I can't answer that question for you, but I will find out and answer that communication either to the committee or to you directly.
And I guess, Barry, I'm not looking for necessarily definitive answers here at this point in time, except for the fact that as we are still undergoing a reorganization, these sort of administrative functions clearly are something that we need to take a hard look at, especially for these facilities that have been supported to a degree by a general fund, but haven't been operating on general fund. It's been an addition, and I guess if we're gonna hit them in one area, that's fine. They could still go out for grants, but if they aren't certified, I don't think their ability to go out to other sources is greatly diminished. So.
Thank you. That is an area where we are concerned because the school-based health centers are part of a larger safety net.
Right.
But I have never received a phone call in which people said preserve administration and state government. I thought it was remarkable.
I guess I took it a different way. I guess, but my concern and I think Representative Mona Sanderson's concern is that we don't inadvertently do things that impair these facilities' ability to go to other funding sources to maintain their operations. So,
Mr. Chairman, we will do what we can to avoid that, and I agree with that direction. Would you like me to move on to mental health and...
Yeah, and I like to begin and end on time, so I think we'll try to save OMAP for Wednesday, and so okay. I'm not even sure we get through mental health in 5 minutes, but we can try.
There are several issues that need to be noted before we go into the reductions.
Right.
One is that over the years, mental health, which was highly dependent on general fund when we had nothing but a state hospital, began shifting to community care, and because the federal government would pay for community care, we maximized federal resources throughout the 80s. When the Oregon Health Plan was developed, those resources then became a part of the Oregon Health Plan. We encouraged the inclusion of mental health services in the plan, and the Health Services Commission had a special subcommittee which looked into that and recommended that. That has two effects. One is that once those dollars are in the Oregon Health Plan, they're then subject to the same kinds of procedural constraints that you'll hear on Wednesday from Lynn. So it makes it more complex to cut the budget. And having said that, then, when our allocations come in, we are then forced to make those reductions in areas where we do have flexibility, and that largely affects people who don't have Medicaid eligibility. So it's a... When you look at all of these cuts taken together, and they're all devastating, mental health infrastructure is really severely compromised by the reductions we've been required to make. A second feature is that these three sets of reductions are related to each other. When we brought forward our rebalance plan in November, what the emergency board did essentially was make some changes in the structure of those reductions. But because the allocations for 5100 were targeted by division in a very specific way, when the emergency board took a mental health cut and moved it forward to the rebalance plan, we were forced to take an additional $3.8 million in mental health cuts in 5100 in the submission we made on January 3rd. Therefore, you have the meteorology of this is like the perfect storm. I mean, you have a combination of factors which, taken together, have forced reductions in mental health, which I don't think anyone would want to see happen. We have a state hospital that we can't cut because of the forensic population and the legal structure of that. We have an Oregon health plan. The cuts in that are restricted. And we have a limited amount of flexible general fund, and that's where those cuts are going to be taken. Having said all of that, I want to be clear that there were some principles involved in making these decisions. The first levels of cuts in mental health were made in fund allocations that were new from the 2001 session, but either had been uncontracted or unspent. Included were new funds to address caseload projections, to improve child and adolescent care in anticipation of problems that are under discussion about the adequacy of children's mental health, and for expanded beds at Oregon State Hospital, which we are postponing. And for how long we'll postpone them is a good, is a probably a legislative question that will come up in your discussions. While the effect of deferring these investments may be serious, and I think they are, they do not require taking something away that has already been invested in a community program. Secondly, we tried to find reductions in general fund expenditures that were not related to public safety. It is very difficult in mental health and in addictions work to find expenditures that are not related to public safety. Our supported employment program, which is a rehabilitation focus, and we think that people with mental illness should be working, is such a program, and it is virtually eliminated by these reductions. Cuts were then made in services, and remember, this is happening in sequence and incrementally. Cuts were made to, in a sense, to preserve a proportion of each service element, so we had some viable structure on which to rebuild if and when that opportunity occurs. And finally, we wanted to wait as long as possible and avoided cuts in services for the most impaired or for settings in which substantial legal barriers to implementation would occur. For example, when a court sends us a patient who has committed a crime but was mentally ill at the time, the discharge of that patient rests with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, not with the physician. So we're limited in what we can cut. And having cut one ward at the Oregon State Hospital, we're now crowding those patients into a smaller number of wards, and there is a limit to how much we can do there. Community extended residential care for adults and children, for example, we made an effort to preserve them. And you've already talked this morning about 122 beds in residential care in large facilities that we are removing from the budget in 5100. These are beds that are all general funded. They represent not no risk, but less risk than a state hospital bed, for example, but they are certainly not free of risk. In response to the question Representative Monis Anderson asked earlier, we have been working since November to find alternatives for every one of these individuals, and there are actions underway which we think will mitigate the effect of these cuts. We are now subject to litigation in this matter, so there's going to be more discussion, and I can't go further on it this morning, but I would be happy to outline for you what we have done to date step by step, and I will see that you get a report on that.
Is there other litigation other than the Multnomah County case? I mean, have other how many have been filed at this point?
Mr. Chair, we had a long meeting on Friday with the Attorney General. And without getting into detail, there are currently several lawsuits. There are three new lawsuits that have been filed in connection with this. And there is discussion of more. So the question you asked Mr. Taves, you could equally ask of mental health and addiction services.
Okay. I mean, you know, I hear about it. It seems like it's one a day. So we're building a very, very interesting box for ourselves here, I think.
The unfortunate, and mindful of the time, I think we'll have to come back and talk about the specific reductions, but as the targeted allocations grew, and particularly after the emergency board, it became very, very difficult to avoid virtually eliminating programs. After the emergency board action, when we went to look for an additional $3.8 million, we had to decide between hospital beds for people who are acutely ill and a community crisis system, and we chose the latter. And whether that's a good choice or not, it was the one that seemed the most feasible and realistic. And that's a very important principle, that deeper cuts, as we were making them, had to be implementable. We didn't want to bring you a set of reductions that you couldn't, that were not realistic and would not result in saving those dollars out of the budget. So hospital bed reductions were considered and rejected wherever it was established that offsetting costs in community settings would exceed the projected savings. That seemed reasonable to us. For example, we considered closing a whole civil commitment unit at Oregon State Hospital that cost us about $300 a day. And those patients certainly would have been forced into community hospital beds costing three times as much. So it's, what a dilemma. And with that, those are the principles we used, and I don't know how you want to proceed, but there's, I would say, half of the reductions on this list are health service reductions, and we ought to walk through them perhaps at your next meeting.
And I think we can bring that back for Wednesday if you'd like. And I guess at the end of all this, Gene, if it's possible, my sense is here that 5100 was a relatively tight box, and the November e-board made that box excruciating. And I'm wondering if you weren't constrained by 5100, if you had alternatives. To achieve, and I'm not asking for anything specific now, but in other words, if you had to make cuts in human services and weren't constrained by the box of 5100, if there is another direction you would have gone, I would be interested in that sort of discussion.
Mr. Chair, and just an initial reaction, and perhaps we can talk more on Wednesday about this. I think there are probably some things around the edges that we would have made some changes. Met with a group of 5100 just by its very size, taking $88 million out of the department the last few months of the biennium. It's hard to, you can't avoid some very serious impacts. I met with a group of alcohol and drug providers the other day who are asking about working with the legislature on restoring mental health and alcohol and drug services that have been cut by the November e-board. I said, if Measure 28 does not pass, to pick out one thing when you have all of this, there are very much more serious reductions in here. On the other hand, if Measure 28 passes, there may be things that are actually on our 5100 list that we would say we would cut those in order to restore, for instance, that outpatient mental health and chemical dependency. We have not, this group said, well, what are you going to do if Measure 28 passes? And I said, we haven't even considered that, frankly, and because we've been so focused on needing to move this ahead. And so we need to engage in that kind of discussion. But we can talk more about that on Wednesday. I think, again, when it came down to when you have $88 million, maybe the last $10 million is where we might have moved some cuts around a little bit. But it's very difficult. James didn't talk with you about the alternative. We had looked at a number of alternatives. No matter how you cut it, we were going to be spending money, more money elsewhere. And in the end, it's going to be extremely difficult for us to make these savings targets. I asked Teresa McHugh, who goes to jail. She didn't answer. when we get down to it, because we have entitlement programs, and if we're off a little bit this late in the biennium in terms of how many clients we think will be affected, it may be extremely difficult for us to make the savings targets as they are.
Okay. Well, and I'm looking at this from the perspective that even if 28 passes, it's a small Band-Aid on a huge wound. And I'm even kind of thinking about some concepts like why fix the last 4 months, just do a 28-month budget. We need to kind of get maybe outside the box here in some ways. There might be a way to do some of these things. So, I just kind of wanted to give you a little forewarning that I'd like a little discussion about anything you perceive as alternatives to the very tight box that you were put in by the legislation. So, thank you very much. We'll see you Wednesday, and we are adjourned. Oh, whoa.